Welcome to the Farcast, coming to you every week with insiders and experts to give you insight into the changing economic world. And now, here's your host, Michael Farr.
Welcome to the Farcast. I'm Michael Farr. Thanks for joining us again this week on August the 4th. We're recording late in the afternoon. We're going to get you out early for our Wednesday release of the Farcast this week. We appreciate you being with us very much, where we talk about Wall Street, Washington, and the world, and its effects on the economy, and how that's going to help or hurt investors, what it's going to mean as we go forward to navigate through this path of uncertainty that is investing, and certainly through a presidential election, a global pandemic, if that's not redundant, and I think it is. Pandemic does mean global. And we're figuring if schools opening or not opening, the vice president's going to pick a candidate, and stock market are doing well. There used to be a money show, radio show in Washington years ago, and they'd come on and say, it's 4 o'clock, do you know where your money is? Always made me wonder, actually, if I did know where my money was at 4 o'clock in the afternoon as markets were closing. Dow Jones Industrial Average trading close to 27,000 again, up another 164 points today. If you've been following the markets, particularly the equity markets, it doesn't matter what the news is, they just keep going higher. S&P was up 0.3 of a point or so today. So was the NASDAQ. We need to understand all of this, and we're going to a Farcast fan favorite, one of your most favorite guys you get to hear from. And thank you for your notes, and thanks for telling us that you love Jim Urio. But we figured you love Jim Urio, and we've got him back to tell us what he thinks right now. Jim Urio from TJM Institutional Services. You see him on the floor of the Chicago Exchange. You see him on CNBC. Take it off of mute and listen to Jim and listen to him on the Farcast. Welcome back.
Thank you, Michael.
We are glad you're here. So, Jim, markets, you agree or disagree with me. It doesn't matter what the news is. They just keep going up. What do you think?
Yes? Well, when the news is bad, and it's, I mean, when you talk about bad news, we've had the most abysmal news of the last 5 months that we could possibly imagine. But it's always met with government stimulus talk or action. It's always met with the Fed saying they're going to keep rates zero forever and they're going to keep buying treasuries. And it's also the rest of the world's central banks keep pouring money into this thing too. And there's an escape velocity that happens from those economies into what is the best. And that's us. And that's why we get a benefit of that as well. So am I shocked that the market's rallying? No, I'm not. And I don't mean to give myself a pat on the back thinking that I'm smarter than everyone else, because I'm not. But I just am more sinister, maybe. And I believe that after that nasty 36% move that bottomed out on March 23rd, a couple things happened. One, so remember, we're coming from all-time highs and we were facing a shock. So that kind of move was exacerbated by market position. And then on March 23rd, the Fed announced indefinite QE, or whatever they called it. And to me, that was like, wow, they're going to support these markets. And it's been a one-way street now since. And I think it's going to take out the all-time highs.
Let's go back there just briefly, Jim. Let's go back to March before the Fed came in. We saw we were going to have a shutdown in the U.S. We were having this global pandemic. They were showing refrigerated trailers stacked up outside of hospitals in Manhattan so that they would have storage room for all of the bodies that they were told they were going to have. We saw that. We knew we were having supply chain disruptions in parts and supplies from China. Ford was going to have to stop production. GM was going to start to have to stop production. We were going to have problems with manufacturing iPhones and everything else. I mean, so the market reaction seemed to me kind of rational that it would go down significantly. Did it to you?
Yeah, not only will I say that, but even in retrospect, what the reality has happened from an economic standpoint, it seems like a reasonable move as well. But then, you know, the Fed came in riding their white horse. But I mean, this has been, you know, from an economic standpoint, this has been all those things you mentioned, you truly happened and much, much more. 40 million people lost their job. Are we healing now? Yeah, but at a very, very slow pace. Restaurant traffic is only at 30% of what it was before. Even TSA check-ins have kind of leveled off after coming off the lows. We are still not in a good place. So the thing that's changed is, you know, the dollar being pounded by the Fed and everything that's been denominated in dollars going higher. And that's why we see, you know, in stocks, in gold, silver, Bitcoin, all of them.
Everything's going up, and we're seeing that inflation in those hard assets. We're also seeing that inflation, I guess, in stock prices, but we don't call that inflation, right? I mean, but this stuff is staying very expensive. You know, I was on CNBC on Friday for the halftime report. Scott Wapner was giving me a hard time because I said, look at all of these FANG stocks. I think they're very expensive at 35 times earnings. And he said, how can you say that? They're not that expensive. They're earning money. These are great companies. And I said, Wapner, I grew up where 14 times earnings was the breaking point. They kind of talked me into 16 times earnings as being the norm. Nobody's going to tell me that 35 times earnings is a reasonable price to pay. I mean, unless you've got, you know, 35% earnings growth every year, even Facebook growing earnings at 20%. I'll buy that one. I think that that's more reasonable. Is there a price out there that seems reasonable to you, or do you just have to say, I have to be along for this ride more as a trader than an investor?
Well, it's a complicated question, and we're going to take it apart because you mentioned earnings multiples. When you talk about zero rates and zero alternative anywhere, you have to adjust your, you know, the Fed model, I think it was Greenspan, but it was... earnings yield versus, you know, investable treasury yield.
Yes.
And that, to me, it makes all the difference in the world. And now we're talking about zero rates out through, well, 0.6 or whatever you want to call it, out to the 10-year. So there's that. Now you talk about the FANG stocks. So at the same time, we needed a place to run and hide and store our money. We're going to zero out rates, making stocks look attractive on that, based on that parameter, not on the economic condition. And we're talking about an actual real story for the information age, the stay-at-home names. So all those 5, 6, 7 names just benefited from those three things hitting at once. I thought last week when they all posted earnings was going to be a big deal for the market to say if they're worthy of the crowns that we've given them all. And we got through those earnings, and it seems like they're saying they are. You know, I still own Amazon, Apple, Google, and it, you know, I've hedged against them a little bit too. But you know, are they worthy? I don't know. We've seen bubbles start to inflate before, and we don't know when they're going to pop is the bad thing. So I'm not in the business of calling the bubble yet.
I own Apple, Google, and Facebook and across portfolios. So, but my point, you know, on TV was, look, if you buy low and sell high, this is not the time when Fred and Ethel should back up the truck on these FANG names as they're still trading at all-time highs. Should they own some? Yeah, they can own some. Should they own all of them? No, I don't think so. Some of them are more reasonably valued than others. I think the Facebook valuation looks very strong. We're looking for 20% growth for the next 3 or 4 years out of Facebook. I think FactSet is too. That's a pretty strong growth rate in any kind of a company. There are other companies you can own and diversify. And I still like the idea of buying stuff that other people don't like. And it makes me nervous to buy stuff that people love. Do you get nervous when you buy it? I mean, buying it when you love it tells me I'm buying it, I'm thinking more as a trader than I am an investor. Do you make that distinction?
Here's the funny part of your question, and it dawned on me as you were asking the question. When I look at those names and I look at the FANG stocks, I'm thinking, should I be selling what I have? Should I be shorting them? It never pops into my head for 1 second, should I be buying them at these lofty levels?
I'm certainly
not going to do that. They've run too far. This is, if they're going to continue higher, they're going to do it with the amount I have on and not one share more. So to answer your question, I would not be backing up the truck. And now I at current levels, I'm almost ready to say the same thing about the other stores of value. And I know that it's weird for people to think of silver and gold in the same sentence as we're talking about the FANG stock, but I believe they all are serving a similar purpose. At least part of that purpose is to be a store of money. And those I don't think are quite over yet, but the FANG stocks I wouldn't be buying at all, and I'm not.
Okay, so let's go there, because Jim Murio, you were on the Farcast months ago talking about silver. And, you know, I'm remembering the Bass Brothers in silver and the Hunt Brothers. I guess it was the Hunt Brothers in silver.
Right.
Hunt Brothers in silver going back to our Utes. as we say in New York, in the Bronx, the Utes, when we had the Hunt brothers, but cornering the silver market as it proceeded to fall directly to the floor. Oh my God, silver dropped like a rock, but silver's not dropping now. Yurio's been buying it for a while. This has got to be are you still in silver? This has got to be a great trade for you.
I'm still in silver. It has been. And people who follow me on Twitter know we talk about this every day. I am not a cowboy. I am more conservative, and I wish I didn't have that gene. I've gotten out of 2/3 of my silver position. Even today, I rolled up and reduced some exposure too, but I'm still long in it. And remember what we talked about, the fundamental wins that I thought were going to push silver higher. Gold had just had that nasty $100 move in late March, and silver had a decent move lower too. And it was about, you know, that was about hedge funds who had to cover margins and had to sell things they owned. So all of a sudden we have something like gold that's responding to this this whole tragedy or crisis, whatever we call it, not the way it's supposed to. And people are like, okay, well, what are we supposed to buy? And then you look at Bitcoin. And I don't think, when you look at Bitcoin as a potential safe haven, you can't say the word safe when you're talking about Bitcoin. It literally has 30-40% moves, you know, on every week or so. And I know I'm exaggerating a little bit on that, but it's just not a safe haven. So I kept going.
Okay, hang on. Let me stop there for a second, because that's an interesting point. Does volatility make something unsafe?
Well, sure, of course. I mean, particularly if you're buying it and then the next day it has a 30% move, well, everything you were trying to avoid, I mean, a move against you, everything you were trying to avoid just happened. I think that...
What if it moves up?
Well, of course, then it's beautiful, but it's still not a safe haven, right?
I like that. Yes, no, there's no question. I agree with you. Absolutely, I agree with you. And Bitcoin is hard to say. It's a fiat currency without a fiat other than the I guess everybody agreeing that there's some sort of fiat out there, and it was a fiat of anonymity and liquidity, but it's not even that anonymous anymore. I'm not sure, but you know, Jack Barugian was buying it, and Jack Barugian was buying gold. He talked about that, and I told him that you were buying silver, and he said he liked the trade. I'm sure it's a trade. Both trades have worked for Jack, both Bitcoin and the other. What about these stores of things that are getting inflated? And you're not going to believe it. We're almost out of time here.
Oh, wow. Yes. So again, I think these things are still make sense to own. I'm not getting out of them yet. And when I look at silver, it's funny because the narrative changes. Like, you know, it's not just a precious. It has some element of industrial metal too. So when you start talking about the rebound and the recovery, then the focus starts to shift. That's something that has an industrial component too. I'm not sure that's fair. I'm not sure what silver's used in, but I know when I see the market shifting its attention and trying to make a backstory up to cover why we're buying it. But for some reason, market seems to like silver better than the others.
Every time somebody's asked me about gold, every time an investor has asked me about gold, Jim, I've always said I don't understand gold. And they get very frustrated with me. And they're like, come on, Farr, you're an expert. You're just not telling us. No, that's not it. You can't work out fundamental value on gold. You really can't work out a fundamental value on silver. So my question, Jim Murillo, is it appropriate, and why would it be appropriate for Fred and Ethel to have gold or silver in their 401k?
Well, okay, I can't figure out the real fundamental story on gold either. It pays you no yield, you can't eat it. If everything really hit the fan, you know, you'd trade every ounce of gold you had for a glass of water or a sandwich. I don't understand it either, but I've been watching it for my entire career, and it definitely seems like the market likes to crown it as a fiat currency proxy, when they believe that our government and our Fed is being cavalier with our currency. Should people, I don't tell people what to do. I don't just do what I do. I tell you what I do myself. And yes, I have it as part of my longer term plan to probably no more than 5-10% of my entire investable, you know, not even that, but I do keep gold and silver. And I think that, because I don't trust the people who are stewards of our currency. They seem to be too aggressive.
Okay, so the government and the standard conventional measures of inflation are saying we are seeing absolutely no inflation. And yet we are seeing these commodities and basic material prices rise, and we're seeing stock market values go up. Are these the new inflation monitors of the modern monetary theory?
I'm so glad the camera's on, because as soon as you started saying that they're telling us that there's no inflation, I did that hand signal that has something to do with a bull that I can't say exactly on your show, because there is inflation. And just because it comes in non-traditional ways that they don't know how to look for it anymore, and they're going down the the bread aisle at the grocery store and saying Wonder Bread's still the same price, they've missed our traditional inflation identifiers have missed it in tech stocks in the early part of the century. They missed it in real estates. They're missing it right now. Timber is up 31 out of 35 of the last days. So they keep telling us there's no inflation because it's a different kind of inflation because they inflate assets. So, I think they have a very difficult time gauging inflation. The market's going to tell us when there's inflation, and gold and silver are telling it right now.
We know all of those things are more expensive. And ladies and gentlemen, if you do look at your gold and you say it's time for a glass of water or a sandwich, you want to go to Brandt's of Palatine, where you can get the best burger in the world. Brandt's of Palatine.
Professional, Michael Farr.
Did you
that
like
was
that?
Beautiful.
I mean, if you've got a little gold, basically you've got Jim Urio's gold and he has your burgers. It's time to trade.
Let's trade.
It's time for a trade. He's a trader. You can figure this out. Jim Urio, you are the best. Thanks so much for being with us on the Farcast. We're going to be right back with Dan Mahaffey. We're going to talk about Washington, a vice presidential nominee, and what's going to happen with the don't mail-in ballots and how that could hurt the Republicans when we come back on the Farcast.
Thank you for joining us on this week's Farcast. We'd like to invite you to follow Michael on Twitter and LinkedIn. On his social media feed, you'll find links to all of Michael's media appearances, articles he's been quoted in such newspapers as The Wall Street Journal and Washington Post, and, of course, The Farcast. Additionally, Michael shares some of the articles we are reading at Farmiller in Washington every morning that we feel have bearing on the investing landscape. That's Michael_K_Farr on Twitter and Michael Farr on LinkedIn. And now, back to Michael and The Farcast. Welcome back to the Farcast, and now here's your host, Michael Farr.
Welcome back. Up now on the Farcast, the great, the renowned, the famous, at least in certain circles, Dan Mahaffey from the Center for the Study of the Presidency and Congress, and the senior political analyst on the Farcast, is with us every week to help interpret what's going on in Washington, around the world, and how that's going to affect investors. Welcome back, Dan.
Thank you, Michael. It's good to be here. Thank you for having me.
We are very glad, and our listeners are always grateful of your time and for your insights. Dan, we have so much to cover here. Let's just delve right in. Are we going to have a relief bill here or not, and when?
Look, I think it's getting harder to see where the common ground is on this. We're already going to have discussions about whether or not August recess even happens. I think there's so much distance between where the Democrats and the Republicans are, as well as the fact that the Republicans are hamstrung, particularly because you have Mnuchin and Meadows playing good cop and bad cop. But they're playing good cop and bad cop with both the Democrats and the president. And you can't do it that way when you're negotiating on behalf of the White House. So that's a dog's breakfast. Do they try and next steps? I think we need to see. Do you get a quick measure, though, on perhaps getting some of those unemployment measures back in place? Some stuff that can be done very quickly compared to some of the longer stuff, like another round of PPP, where they're far apart on stimulus to states and local governments, that might take longer.
So, okay, so wait a minute. You're saying that you think we're going to see a stopgap plan?
So we're at a fork in the road right now, Michael, I think. You have either one fork we take, it becomes the stopgap plan. We're going to take this bit by bit and try and push it along.
Will the Democrats agree to that? Wait a minute. Will the Democrats agree to that?
I don't think the Democrats will, unless they get something. But they can do it, though. If they start trying to slice it off, they might say, okay, we'll do it. But we want the full 600 in unemployment and guaranteed until February of 2021. So they're going to raise the price of this piecemeal compared to what they would get whole hog if you're the Democrats.
So my question again is, will that happen? Will they do it or not do it?
They're going to try and do it if the Republicans start to spend. That's the challenge. And it's the pulse that McConnell has on the Republicans of, can I hold to the principles of not spending, or do I have so many unemployed and out of work and closed businesses in my state that orthodoxy be damned, we've got to open the taps.
When do I see a deal? When does this deal happen? When do I get that? Or when do I get another stimulus relief bill, something? When?
Michael, I can't really tell you right now because it's the equivalent of a hurricane that has sat off the coast and just stalled and is sitting there, and we're waiting for it to start moving again and wonder where it's going to head. And so you have Meadows and Mnuchin, again, like I said, good cop, bad cop. The Democrats are waiting to see if the GOP can get on a single sheet of music, which is not a good positioning place to be in.
And this is going to be bad for the GOP. This is really bad.
It's going to be terrible for the GOP. And I wonder, too, when markets start to get a sense of, you know, when's the cliff, when's the deadline, because we moved through that unemployment one pretty well. But when does this also start to get seen in markets? Because the playbook of every crisis is that it's not until the markets have a tantrum about what Congress is doing that they perhaps start to move.
So we're going to watch, and we're going to talk to Jeff Lacker when we come up. How long will the Fed wait for a relief bill? How frustrated and how anxious is Jay Powell actually becoming? I mean, that's a big deal. One of the things in this bill is COVID indemnity for employers. Why is that such a big deal?
Well, it's a big deal for business because no one wants to get their business open and face a bevy of lawsuits, particularly if they've held to the state and local, as well as federal reopening distancing standards. So that needs to be put in there. It's again, a hot button issue for the trial lawyer litigators lobby on the left, the business lobby on the right. It should be in there for good functioning. I think it's a bargaining chip.
The trial lawyers are against it, aren't they? The trial lawyer litigators are against that indemnity, and the businesses are for it. And the trial lawyers want to just go out and sue all the businesses so that they can make 30% of the fee.
But thus far, though, Michael, correct. But thus far, though, we've actually seen little evidence in the legal system of COVID-related workplace cases actually happening.
Lawyers,
we know they will smell the blood in the water and find their way there. But it's a question has become, how big of an issue is it, and where does that rank on the hierarchy of bargaining chips? Because for McConnell, it's a must have. Yeah. The White House, it depends on who you talk to.
Those types of lawyers who are looking just to sort of profit. Are the worst kind of pond scum out there. They're not concerned about the people who are going to get their checks. They're not concerned about the people and the vulnerable and the fragile who are suffering. They are just concerned about how they're going to get in there. Those types of lawyers are why you get the old jokes of, what do you call 100 lawyers at the bottom of the Potomac River, right? But the answer is a good start, and those are horrible jokes, and I don't agree with any of those jokes, and I love lots of lawyers. I got two sisters that are lawyers. I got brothers-in-law who are lawyers. I got a lot of lawyers in my family, and they're very nice people, but some of them are not so much. Let's move on. The president is weighing in and doesn't like this company called TikTok. Yeah. And he wanted them shut down and killed and dead until Microsoft said they'd buy them. And then it seemed that the president was going to endorse that. And then I'm not sure that the president was going to endorse it. And then the president suggested that the government should get a fee, a key fee, I think he called it, for helping arrange the deal, the investment banking deal between TikTok and Microsoft. I am utterly stunned and out of my depth at this new role of government. Can you please, dear God, explain this one to me, Mahaffey?
Well, TikTok, first of all, I think the headline of this is, we call it capitalism with Trumpian characteristics, opposed to the capitalism with Chinese characteristics. Look, anyone who has teenage kids will know what TikTok is. It's the short video social media app. It also happens to be run by a Chinese company. And the more you look at this app, it collects a lot of data on people. And the more security-minded of us would say, why does a Chinese data mining app want to know so much about what America's youth are doing and talking about online? And it's all sorts of this digital mess of an economy. But going in there and saying, look, the U.S. government is going to elbow out, the Chinese owner of this company, force a sale to Microsoft, and expect a state cut of it. That sounds more like the Beijing playbook than the Washington playbook for handling this. And at the same time, so there are ways you could structure it. There are ways you could do further reviews, have a sale. But when you have Trump sound like this, it really lowers the U.S. leadership on the rule of law, market, competition issues. And it's all over TikTok. It's a social media app. It's not Huawei. It's not 5G. It's not strategic technology that's the crown jewels.
Does this deal get done? Does TikTok become a part of Microsoft? Microsoft stock didn't have a good day today and with the wake of all of this noise.
I think they try and do it in a way to burnish their credentials with the government. It's sort of like how these companies have gone along with the ventilator production or stuff. You know, you want to be there for the optics of it, but at the end of the day, what's the actual business outcome? And there's no clear plan from the administration to affect it. I don't even know if they could get this cut of money for the Treasury like they say they could.
It strikes me as entirely absurd, a cut for the government because that there's going to be a private industry deal. It just makes no sense.
And then
to
Navarro
me at all.
Coming on and saying that then Microsoft is going to divest itself of all its, that the tech companies should divest themselves of their highly profitable assets in China.
Mr. Navarro never ceases to surprise with many of his comments and interpretations. The only thing that you don't know about Peter, and I know Peter, the only thing you don't know is at the extent that he's just out there and maybe not tracking very well someday, or is he carrying water and sending up trial balloons?
So, Dan, explain to me these sort of outbursts from Peter Navarro that seem somewhat out of left field. Is he actually spending too much time in left field?
Well, I think it's one, a sign of that the people who have the China hawk hat are in the driver's seat when it comes to the White House's policies, given that the election, the harder line on China, the trade deal, that's no longer part of the messaging. I think, too, you have a sense of, look, the things Navarro has gotten away with, no other White House would have had some staffer being that enterprising. So it reflects where the president's mind is, where he wants to be hard on China, that Navarro has that freedom of action and others like Meadows can't rein him in.
He's always interesting whenever you see him show up on television. Listen, you have no idea what you're going to hear. Two other issues we've got to get to, Dan. Let's go to the vice presidential pick. Democrats are pawing at the ground, wishing Joe Biden would come forward with that pick. They think he's taking too long and that there's infighting that seems to be building. As you look at the Mr. Biden's short list of potential candidates, the one thing that strikes you is that there's nothing short about his short list. How have so many people stayed in there for so long? And where does this end up? And will we hear actually soon?
Well, I think there's a lot of jockeying given that whoever gets this position is going to be perhaps the standard bearer for the next generation of Democratic politics, given Vice President Biden's age, as well as someone who could very likely, we'll say, be the next president of the United States. So those are things that they want to take seriously. I think we also do need to consider there is the fact that you want to have a Hippocratic oath when it comes to picking your vice president, which is to first do no harm. And at a time when they want to make sure that the attention stays on President Trump, to make sure that this vice presidential pick is free of any kind of scandal or gotcha moment that could derail the momentum they have right now.
Kamala Harris back on top. Who do you pick?
I think, again, I still, and perhaps I project a bit in terms of who I want to see, I think Duckworth answers a lot of those do-no-harm concerns that you may have. Kamala Harris is very divisive, and I think some of the other ones that are on that list might harm the suburban voter who's on the fence, who doesn't want a very progressive platform, but just wants a little more calm to return to the White House.
Elizabeth Warren's still on the list. Has she got a shot?
I think she's on the list. I think she's always a contender. But if you look more and more where the Senate could possibly turn blue, she could probably do more for their agenda there.
Finally, Dan, and we're watching. Will we hear this week from the vice president as to his nominee?
I think we will. I think they want to kind of keep that process from going on too long. I think it's something we also need to be considering as we look at this, the trouble Democrats had in the House in putting together the Homeland Security bill this year. I think it's a conversation we need to start to have in coming weeks, is if we start to think about a blue wave, okay, when the Democrats do actually take control, what are they actually going to be able to get done, given the gulfs that exist within their own caucus? So let's be realistic about that.
You still think we're going to have a blue wave?
I think it still looks likely if the election were held today. But then let's start to think through those scenarios of what will happen if there is the blue wave, and what that Democratic Party looks like and what they could meaningfully accomplish.
Our friend Greg Valliere made an interesting point this morning that I hadn't thought about. The president's railing and ranting against mail-in voting, could be horribly crippling to his campaign in the Republican Party, because his base might become so off-put by mailing in their vote that they simply won't trust that process, while every Democrat out there is going to go ahead and cast a mail-in ballot. And all of a sudden, he's essentially keeping from Republicans from voting, unless his entire base actually shows up at the polls. But
it's entirely counterproductive, Michael. And what also worries me is we're starting to see in the polling data and some of the information that the likely scenario that we could see on election night is that the in-person voter is depressed by concerns about the coronavirus. So that turnout is depressed, but is still heavily favoring Trump, since Democrats and others will probably have voted beforehand. Those in opposition to Trump are more likely to vote by mail or absentee. We're seeing that in the data. People who want to vote for Trump in person, people vote for Biden absentee. The initial returns on election night are likely going to look very good for President Trump at first in some of these swing states, but then change as the night goes on. So that's also part of this strategy now, to say, look, there's something fishy about it. It's setting the table for disinformation or confusion about the outcome that night.
Well, last week, the president suggested that he wouldn't, but maybe he wasn't just going to hold an election because they couldn't handle all the mail-in votes. The senior members of the Republican Party came out and said, oh, yes, we will. So that didn't seem to go anywhere. But this issue of a legitimate election seems to be growing, or an illegitimate election, if you will, Dan. Is that really going to be a major issue? And what could the fallout be? And we've got to finish, Dan. I'm sorry.
I think it's a major issue. I think the fallout is uncertainty, confusion, other countries looking to say that, look, the American system is not legitimate. And I think we need to begin to think about this in terms of a public education exercise, and almost a civil defense exercise, given the types of people who are just going to want to sow further confusion in November.
Senior political analyst for the Farcast from the Center for the Study of the Presidency and Congress, Dan Mahaffey, you're the best. When we come back, ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Jeffrey Lacker, the former president of the Richmond Federal Reserve Bank, who's going to talk about what's going on at the Fed. Is the policy correct? Is monetary theory actually being proven out here? And what's going to happen with the Fed through the election? All when we come back on the Farcast. Please stay with us.
Thank you for joining us on this week's Farcast. Every week, we bring you experts and insiders to give a deeper understanding of our changing world. If you would be interested in Michael Farr delivering a presentation on the economic forecast for 2021 and beyond, please contact me, Harry Jennings, at 202-530-5608 or email me at hjennings@farrmiller.com. In the past, Michael has delivered presentations at such venues as the Palm Beach Chamber of Commerce, the YPO Economic Summit, and the University of Delaware Economic Forecast. We are booking now for late 2020 and early 2021 for events where Michael will share his views into the recovery from the pandemic, including the consequences of the stimulus and the opportunities for investors. Reserve your date now on Michael Farr's speaking schedule. And now, back to Michael and the Farrcast. Thank you for joining us on the Farrcast. And now, back to your host, Michael Farr.
Welcome back to the Farrcast. In our third segment, it is a terrific honor to have my friend Dr. Jeffrey Lacker, former president of the Richmond Federal Reserve Bank, back with us. He's now a distinguished professor in the Department of Economics, Virginia Commonwealth University of Business in Richmond, Virginia, one of the nation's leading voices in economics, in monetary policy, and also one of the nicest, most reasonable guys you're ever going to talk to. Welcome back to the Farrcast, Jeff.
Well, thank you very much, Michael. I'm glad you're well and healthy. Weathered the storm pretty well. We did pretty well down here in Richmond, but thank you for that very kind introduction.
We had this tropical storm hurricane come through. We were without power most of the day, but everything's hunky-dory now. We're all good, and the air conditioning's back on.
Online.
It's the best. Okay, so I have to confess, when the air conditioning went off and it started to get hot in the house, I thought, damn, air conditioning doesn't work. I walked over to the light switch to turn on the ceiling fan. And I said, I flipped that thing three times before I figured out.
Before it dawned on you.
This is probably going to
Maybe there's a more fundamental cause here.
Probably not going to work. It's not just the air conditioning that's out. All right.
There's a lesson in there for financial advisors, I think.
Yes, definitely. But I don't know that I want all my clients to be thinking about that for too long, that I'm standing there flipping the switch. It's like you're leaning into the door that says pull, you know?
Perseverance. There's something to be said for perseverance.
Tenacity. We'll go with that. Okay. A remarkable year, Dr. Lacker. And here we are, a balance sheet of $7 trillion at your Federal Reserve Bank, and it's going higher. Yeah. Any concerns? What do you make of that? Has the Fed done the right thing? Would you have $7 trillion on your balance sheet if you were chairman?
I think the Fed's purchases of U.S. Treasury securities were warranted in March, and expanding the balance sheet through buying government securities makes perfect sense at a time like this. Just to add to the reserves on hand in the banking system to reduce the likelihood of short-run disruptions like they had last September. But beyond that, I think the interventions in credit markets come with a lot of concern about the effect on incentives and what expectations they're setting up for how people are going to approach risk management coming out of this. You're a corporate debt issuer, or you're considering buying corporate debt. Now it looks like you've got to put in any substantial downturn, the Fed might intervene in the corporate debt market to prop up prices. So I think it comes with some caveats.
Let's get this really clear for Fred and Ethel. So Dr. Lacker is saying, one, he would have bought treasuries. I didn't hear him say whether he would have bought mortgages. I did hear him say he wouldn't have bought corporates. And anything more esoteric than corporates, he sure wouldn't have done if he didn't do corporates. And it creates a further moral hazard, because if the government starts buying one corporation's bond and basically providing them financing for their debt, and they don't buy another corporation's bond, then isn't the government picking winners and losers? Should the government be in that position? And is that basically, am I translating that okay?
That's it. Yeah, I mean, the Fed treads on delicate ground when they do, as you say, sort of pick winners and losers. Inevitably, when they design a program, they have some qualifying standards and they get criticized for the people they left out and raise legitimate questions about that. But even for the people they let into the program, it's going to affect the incentives of people looking forward. You know, as we come out of this, when there's a recovery and things are going well, people are thinking about risks, thinking about, all right, I got to prepare, I got to do something for a rainy day. They're going to look back at two recessions now in a row in which the Fed has intervened in a massive way to rescue investors in particular institutions. First in 07 and 08 in right. Big banks and big financial institutions. And now in, you know, a wide range of institutions, municipalities, for example, corporate debt, Main Street lending, just across the board, the breadth of their intervention is pretty breathtaking and is going to set up some precedents that I think are going to affect financial behavior going forward. And I think encourage more risk taking than we really want. Encourage people to not really take the precautions they need financially for downturns, which are inevitable. Inevitably, we get shocks in our economy.
So this is interesting because we've been talking about on earlier sections, segments here on the Farcast, some of the higher prices we're seeing on Wall Street. I was on a Halftime Report last week, and we were talking about the FANG earnings, and they were all so great. Facebook, Amazon, Apple, all of them, Google, so good. But they were saying, well, these are the ones we should be buying. And I said, wait a minute, these things are trading at 35 times earnings. But Michael, these are the companies who are executing. These are the companies that are making money. These are the companies you need to own. And I said, hang on, you don't send Fred and Ethel out to buy companies that are trading at all-time highs and at 35 times earnings. And they said, 35 times earnings is not a big deal, Michael. That's the new normal. And I went, no, no, no. I grew up where 14 times earnings is the right number. 16 times earnings you can talk me into. Maybe at a 0% interest rate, I'll go to 18 times earnings. You're not going to get me on a 30 multiple on earnings. I can't do it, Jeff. So, you know, on the one hand, folks are saying we're not seeing inflation from this monetary policy. I think that we are seeing certain asset levels that are being inflated. But it's not just the monetary policy is what I'm hearing you say. I'm hearing you say it's also the lack of risk that's encouraging the added risk taking that's driving prices higher. Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, it's as if the Fed has been striving to take downside risk out of financial asset prices, particularly debt markets.
Why do they feel they need to do that?
So they have this perspective that their job is to ameliorate distress in financial markets. And pretty much what qualifies as distress is somebody not getting a price they really wanted and used to be able to get. So when corporate debt trading spreads widened, when U.S. Treasury spreads widened, when corporate debt spreads widened, you know, reflecting the risk, the obvious risk that it increased in March, the Fed viewed that as a dysfunctional market, and they have this intellectual apparatus, this sort of paradigm that leads them to want to try and smooth out risk premia across the business cycle, even when risks really genuinely go up, as they did in March. I mean, it was a scary place in March.
Okay, so the message is that we're hearing from the Fed and from other areas of government, and certainly from the Treasury Department, the economy remains in deep trouble. This was a huge, huge recession, 32% drop. This is a big, big deal. How is the economy now? Is it as bad as we're hearing? Do we still require all of the stimulus and all the support? I mean, it seems like, you know, everybody's hair's on fire that we don't get this relief bill passed in Congress and that the economy is going to go into a deeper, further recession. Is it that fragile? What's your opinion?
So I think we're in a a turning point here, a little cusp here, a little inflection point here. You know, we shut down the economy in mid-March. We've let things rise. They've come back, but they've plateaued at a level of economic activity that's well below what we had in January and in years past. And we're not going to move ahead until we can get clear of the virus, until industries like, you know, entertainment, travel, leisure, you know, hotels and the like, restaurants, until the whole range of activity comes back. And as long as you've got a fraction of the economy shut down, well, the economy is only generating a fraction of the income it used to generate. So
yes,
the relief isn't going to stimulate the economy as much as it is going to rearrange the allocation of the burden of incomes falling by as much as they have. And what you'd like is for the burden to be lifted, you know, for some of the burden to be shared more widely. The way Congress and the administration have approached this is to have the burden shared by future taxpayers, running up $4.5 trillion of debt in 1 year. Just astonishing. And it's a burden that taxpayers in the future are going to bear to pay off what the government's doing to rearrange.
How else would you do it? If you don't have the tax money and you don't have if you don't have the debt, how would you do it?
Well, you know, if you look at disposable income, it skyrocketed in the spring, and people saved it. Savings rate went up from under 10% to over 25%. And that's an indication we're giving away money that people don't have anything to spend on. Supply is limiting demand. And we didn't need to have been as generous as we did. It seems clear in hindsight.
So, well, that's fascinating. Did we have to be somewhat generous? I mean, we are. A lot of that has been thinking more socially and not economically, that there are some people who are really vulnerable, very much at risk, who did need some financial support. But sending every American under a certain pay level, that money, you think a lot of it did go to savings?
Well, yeah, a lot of it did. That's pretty clear in the data. I mean, I think the trade-off people faced in March was wanting to get money out of the door rapidly, and any effort to make sure that it was targeted at the people who really needed it was going to slow down getting the money out the door. So they were willing to take on the cost, as it were, of distributing it to people, including people who probably didn't need it, and in order to achieve, you know, getting it out the door rapidly.
Okay, so I take your first point that the economic activity is lower because there's still certain areas of the economy that are going to shut down, and probably stimulus dollars are not going to open those or get those moving again, if I'm hearing you correctly. Is an additional relief bill that Congress is arguing about right now, and it sounds like Jay Powell is telling the Congress they've got to do something, is it necessary, and what will it accomplish over the next 6 months if we remain shut, as we likely will over COVID?
You know, it's not clear. I mean, you know, they're fighting about a bunch of different pieces of a fiscal plan. You know, I think fundamentally the COVID virus is controlling the path of the economy. You may have noticed the FOMC added a sentence to their statement last week, and I think it was a very deliberate move on their part, one designed to just very clearly signal that that there were limits to how much the Fed could do. What did they write? The path of the economy will depend significantly on the course of the virus, and they put that at the lead of a paragraph. And
yeah,
you know, they couldn't have said more loudly, look, don't count on us to fix all of this. But I think the same thing goes for Congress too. I mean, don't count on Congress to be able to fix what is burdening us, because the virus is really holding back activity.
Michael and Dr. Lacker continued their conversation on the economic outlook, and we kept the tape rolling. Look for an extended bonus edition of the Farcast with the extended conversation coming soon. Thank you for joining us on this week's Farcast. We hope you enjoy the show, and we'll share with a friend. And a special thanks to Michael's guest, Jim Murio, Dan Mahaffey, and Dr. Jeffrey Lacker. The Farcast is produced by Michael Farr and Harry Jennings and is available for free on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, and all major podcast platforms. Please subscribe and don't miss a minute. We'd love to hear from you. You can reach me at hjennings@farmiller.com. Let us know what questions you have, topics you'd like us to cover as we begin planning for Season 4 of the Farcast coming soon. We would like to remind you that the Farcast podcast is for informational purposes only and it should not be considered legal or financial advice. Any mention of a specific security should not be construed as a recommendation to buy or sell, and please be aware that past performance is not a guide to the future performance of any index, fund, manager, or strategy. Before you make any investment decision, we strongly recommend you consult with a financial professional to determine what may be best for your individual needs and your goals. And if we can be of assistance at Farm Miller in Washington, please reach out to me at hjennings@farmmiller.com. We are here to help, and I'll be happy to put you in touch with one of our investment professionals for a portfolio review and a discussion of your investment goals. Join us next week as we continue to go beyond the headlines with the Farcast, Wall Street, Washington, and the world.